This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Over the course of the 16th and early 17th centuries, Mughal court painters evolved from illustrators of manuscripts and albums to active mediators of imperial visionary experience, cultivating their patrons' earthly and spiritual authority. The brush of insight, artist, and agency at the Mughal court traces this shift, demonstrating how royal artists created a new visual economy that featured highly naturalistic royal portraits and depictions of emperors' dreams. These images, in turn, shaped the perceptions of Mughal emperors' preeminence in all domains, temporal and spiritual, from the reign of Akbar to that of his son and successor, Jahangir. In analyzing a wide range of visual materials, including manuscripts, albums, and coins, art historian Ya'el Rice documents how manuscript painters and paintings challenge the status of writing as the primary medium for the transmission of knowledge and experience. The Brush of Insight probes how pictures and illustrated books became central to imperial modes of seeing and being in early modern Mughal South Asia. In our conversation, we discussed royal court culture, illustrated manuscripts, the role of painters, the collective foundations of the workshop, sacred kingship and Sufi sheikhs, artists as mediators between the spiritual and material worlds, the celebration of Nowruz, and the creation of a specific Mughal artistic style and professional identity. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. And now, here's my conversation with Ya'el Rice about The Brush of Insight, Artists and Agency at the Mughal Court, published with the University of Washington Press in 2023. Welcome, Ya'el. Thank you for joining me on New Books in Islamic Studies. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, excited to talk about your not only wonderful to read, but wonderful to look at book, The Brush of Insight. Before we get into it, can you tell us a little bit about your scholarly trajectory, perhaps mentors or moments in your kind of upbringing or training that brought you to study Islamic art?
Yeah, I am by training an art historian. And I think it would be helpful to basically set the stage by saying I came to my PhD program and I did that work at the University of Pennsylvania, intending actually to specialize in the architecture of Sultanate India. So that would be kind of broadly 12th to 16th century. And my very first semester of grad school, and I was there studying with two specialists, the South Asianist Michael Meister and the Islamicist, again, in the Department of the History of Art at Penn. And that is Professor Renata Holid. And my very first semester, Renata Holid offered a graduate, actually it's a graduate and undergraduate seminar focused on a single illustrated manuscript that's in the collections of the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Anthropology and Archaeology. And it was a really, really unique experience to work with, I think, 10 or 11 students. Renata, we also had as her collaborator, a Persian instructor at the university. And it was a whole semester focusing, digging into this single, in this case, a 16th century illustrated copy of the Iranian poet Nizami's Hamsa. And it was just this completely engrossing experience for me. And I'll say some of the methods that we employed, and this really speaks to Renata's own training, were in a way archaeological and architectural in nature. We were really kind of doing in almost a kind of excavation of this manuscript, looking at everything from the subject matter that was illustrated, the appearance of the calligraphy, how the scribe or scribes actually copied the calligraphy in Persian, which is executed in this kind of cursive nastaliq script, looking at other kinds of evidence of making, erasure, additions, reader's marks, the whole gamut. And so I'll just say in short that by the end of the semester, I had really shifted direction. Not that I've left architecture and the history of the built environment completely behind, but manuscripts were it for me. And that's really what started me on the path, at least in grad school, down, you know, the study of book history, largely.
Yeah, I could imagine that would be an amazing experience, and one that would certainly steer you into a certain direction. So this project deals with different materials. Can you talk a little bit about how this project began to emerge as a book, and then perhaps some of the kind of broader conceptual interventions you were hoping to make with the book?
Mm-hmm. So it does largely fixate on books, and of course, certain kinds of books, not ordinary books per se. These are books that were made in the imperial workshops of the Mughal Empire. This is, of course, an Islamic empire that rules over much of South Asia from the 16th century to the mid-19th century. My book happens to focus on these illustrated handmade books, manuscripts that are made there at the various kinds of workshops and courts across South Asia from the end of the 16th into the early 17th centuries. So it's very much book focused, though I do, as you mentioned, bring in other kinds of materials, and these include coins, European prints that help to kind of fill out the picture of the types of media that royal painters employed at the court were actually involved with. And by involved with, I mean, in the case of imperial Mughal coinage, I suggest, I think it's pretty clear that they're actually designing some of the pictorial figural coins that especially are, you know, famous and associated with the patronage of the Emperor Jahangir. These are the kind of famous coins bearing his portrait image. He's also associated with a whole series of astrological coinage that again bear the signs of the zodiac. So this, to me, it sheds light on various kinds of issues that the book is concerned with, but in particular, I wanted to show how painters are not just active in the realm of painting or just in the realm of books, which could have a kind of limited circulation, but in fact are the kind of originators of the designs on these special kinds of coins that are then gifted, we believe, by the emperor to a number of different subjects, and then kind of go out into the world. These subjects, these courtiers, these nobles actually wear some of these coins with the emperor's portrait image on them, on their turbans, around their necks. And so in short, the kinds of designs, images, the kind of ground plan of images that painters are responsible for have this kind of larger life out in the world. And in terms of the conceptual issues that I wanted to bring to the fore with this book, they have to do with, you know, what is it that painters actually do? What are their larger roles in a court society beyond sort of this top-down understanding of that is really sort of historically, I think, how the production of illustrated manuscripts and related materials has been viewed, that essentially you have the emperor, the patron, who's kind of devising everything, who's the kind of mastermind behind design, production, and so on. And that just somehow or other filtered down to the artists that then materialize, right, the emperor's vision, so to speak. My book tries to make the case that that actually it's the painters, the artists, who are kind of filling in a lot of that that work, that they are in unique and unusual ways actually contributing, I guess unique, original, and substantive ways, contributing to the kind of ideology, the discourse of sovereignty that's actually being advanced. They're not just sort of acting on command. They are, again, contributing to this sort of unique vision of sovereignty that's taking shape in South Asia at this court at this moment.
Now, a lot of listeners might not know kind of the ins and outs of the court and the role of manuscript painters within this. Can you kind of give us a little bit of an overview of court culture, what types of ventures were happening through the central court, and then how were the manuscript painters involved in these activities?
Yeah, so the Mughals first established a small kingdom, let's say, small empire in South Asia in the 1520s. They are themselves of Central Asian Turkic origin. They claim descent from the great Turkic warlord of the 15th century, Timur, on their father's side, and from Genghis Khan, the Mongol ruler, on their mother's side. And I say this also because it means that they draw from or kind of possess this inheritance of cosmopolitan aesthetic consumption that goes back hundreds of years, in which the patronage of illustrated manuscripts, both their production but also the collection, was very, very central. So in other words, they belong to a larger Persianate sort of courtly tradition, where it was incumbent upon princes, upon sultans, to be knowledgeable of various kinds of poetic and prose traditions. You know, this includes, of course, Nizami. It includes the poetry of Sa'di, of Jami, among others. To be familiar with it, to be able to kind of speak intelligently about themes that these texts raise, but also to know these texts in material format, right? Which means material texts in the form of manuscripts and related types of materials, so that they could also extemporaneously speak about the, you know, what paintings might contribute to these, again, material texts. And some of the princes, in fact, and that includes the Mughal Emperor Akbar, the third of the Mughal emperors, famously received instruction in painting. So this, again, was part of the education of princes and how one in these kind of Persianate societies became cultured and savvy, let's say. So the Mughals, upon kind of instantiating rule in South Asia, bring this these traditions with them. They, of course, are already in a way kind of pre-existing in South Asia, but they amplify them to the extent that under Akbar, who rules from 1556 to 1605, in his imperial workshop / library, what's called in Persian the Kitabkhane, or Tasvir Khane, the house of images or house of books, he inaugurates this sort of intensive bookmaking and book reclaiming project that goes on for decades, where literally thousands of illustrated manuscript paintings are produced. I can't even think of a comparable case, at least contemporary with the Mughal Empire, where you have this volume of illustrated manuscripts that are being made off the bat, I mean, from scratch. And as I talk about in the book, this includes a new text. So not just the kind of canonical corpus, again, you know, including Nizami's Hamsa and other kinds of texts, or the Shahnameh of Ferdowsi, which had by this point been illustrated in manuscript format for centuries, but entirely new texts that are being composed, edited at the Mughal court at the very same time that they're being illustrated. This is, you know, this means that if we can picture this, we have this bustling workshop employing over 100 painters, not to mention paper burnishers, color mixers, binders, all the other kind of skilled professionals that are required to keep a workshop of this size, this magnitude going. And I like to paint that picture, so to speak, just to impress upon us, you know, just in terms of labor, volume, numbers, how substantial the kind of book making, and I should say also book preservation, because they're also preserving and updating older manuscripts, in particular Timurid manuscripts that the emperors and princes collect. You know, how just so kind of substantial and busy these enterprises were. And I think that, again, speaks to the degree to which for the empire itself, the emperor, the court, the administration, how kind of consequential illustrated manuscripts were understood to be.
You go into a little bit more detail later on in the book about this relationship between the workshop and the empire. And if it's okay, maybe I'll jump there because you kind of talk about how there's collective foundations of the workshop, you know, including folks that you're talking about, paper makers and colorists and designers and the artists. And part of what you do is you talk about how this kind of collective organization was part of what produced this artistic style and a professional identity among the participants. Can you kind of just talk about that part of it a little bit?
Yeah. So this section of the book, which is where I make the case that it's really a kind of collective, in a way, bureaucratic corporate identity that is formed among these manuscript painters, especially during the last decades of Akbar's reign. That this is, in a way, a response to what has been the consensus in scholarship on the Mughal court and its manuscript workshop, that certainly people have long been aware that this was a workshop that employed many, many, many artists. Again, we have the evidence from inscriptions that over 100 painters were employed at various points in time by Akbar's workshop. But the way that these artists have been understood is really within the mold of the master, so the master artist. And that it's these kinds of few individual painters who are really responsible for innovating the Mughal manuscript painting style over the course of the 1580s and 1590s. And thus they are, you know, sort of the most consequential players. So what I do, I think, a little differently is to say, actually, if we look really closely at the way that these painters are working in collaboration, because this tended to be, that is, in collaboration, designers working with colorists in pairs or trios on a single illustration in a manuscript, that this was a kind of modus operandi for the most part, not exclusively. There certainly were manuscripts containing illustrations where, you know, a single artist works solo on that work. But overwhelmingly, it's the case that they're working in collaboration. If we kind of start to look at the way that they work together, and this is where my interest in the digital humanities and digital humanities tools and approaches comes in. I use network analysis and social network analysis and network graphing to, in effect, chart these patterns of collaboration across several of these manuscripts with many, many, many illustrations where we have concrete evidence that artists collaborate together. And out of this picture, we start to see, or at least I think we see emerge a kind of corporate identity where artists more often than not, again, are sort of teaching each other. They are filling in each other's designs. They are fixing or touching up the finished paintings of other artists. And I think it's really out of this that we start to see solidify what is a kind of, again, this sort of corporate sense of self as a kind of member of a workshop, member of an administration, member of a society, as opposed to, again, this model of the kind of single lone master artist, which I think doesn't really quite fit both the period and the context. To me, it seems a kind of anachronistic way of understanding how court painters operated within this particular setting.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Now, you go into much greater detail on this topic within the individual chapters, but perhaps just kind of from a general perspective, one of the things you do across many of the chapters is talk about this relationship between the illustrated manuscripts themselves, the painters as kind of agents of them, and their relationship to religious knowledge or some sort of spiritual insight. Can you just kind of, I'm sure this will come up later, but kind of in a overview type perspective, what are the types of religious perspectives or traditions that the artists are drawing from in their creations, and how did they serve as kind of mediators between spiritual and material worlds in some way?
So I think one of the primary examples is these depictions of Jahangir's dreams that I opened the book with, the very first chapter. And in that, I really focus on a period of about 10 to 15 years or even less. So during the 16 teens, when Akbar's son and successor, Jahangir, is reigning. And coincident with his reign, we have this group of, I'd say about 5, 6, 7 paintings or so that depict Jahangir doing rather unusual things. And unusual really in the context of the longer history of imperial portraiture from across the Islamic world. And I would add to that across South Asia too. One of my favorite examples is this painting, and it's probably known to most of your listeners. It's been reproduced widely, but it's this image of Jahangir embracing the Safavid Shah Abbas. They are both standing on what looks like a European terrestrial globe. And Jahangir, of course, very pointedly, it's a standing on an animal, Jahangir and the lion, Shah Abbas on the diminutive prey of the lion, which is a predator. In this case, he stands on a lamb. And it's clearly making a kind of political statement. This image of Shah Abbas being subdued by Jahangir, the fact too that the lion that Jahangir stands on is actually covering not only what was then the borders of the Mughal Empire, but a huge chunk of Iran as well. So there's no mistake about this. This is not necessarily only a scene of, brotherly affection. Incidentally, the two rulers actually never met in person during their lives. But this is about a sort of wish for political expansion on the part of the Mughal emperor. What's interesting about it is the way that the artist actually frames this statement about territorial material rule. He states actually in Persian inscriptions that appear in the painting that what we are seeing, what the viewer witnesses in the painting, is in fact the contents of a dream. And this is a dream that the Emperor Jahangir apparently had in a very, very special location, which was Cheshmi Nur, which means the spring of light, which was a, or is, because it still exists, a spring located just outside of Ajmer in today's Rajasthan, which was associated with the daughter of the Chishti Sufi Sheikh, Moinuddin Chishti, whose darga or shrine, famously sits in the center of Ajmer. This is all to say that it's not only the dream that's significant, but actually where the dream comes to Jahangir, in this kind of, spiritually endowed place or geography that was and is still deeply connected with this Chishti saint and his baraka, or his kind of spiritual emanation. Dreams, of course, were not necessarily understood to come from the subconscious as we might understand them today, but in the 17th century, Jahangir's dream, especially one with such kind of, a sense of foretelling and impact, would have been understood to have come from some kind of heavenly sphere, from God, God directly, even. So in short, this painting and some of the others that I talk about in the first chapter really harness this discourse about dreams, oneirocorticism, and attest to a deep understanding on the part of the artist in the kind of power of the dream discourse to articulate or express certain kinds of desires or perceived desires on the part of a political sovereign without necessarily assigning sort of the will behind them to the emperor. In this case, if you say you had a dream that you're going to subdue or conquer Shah Abbas, you're claiming that this is a vision of the future that's coming from somewhere else, from some divine source. It's not of your own making. So that's powerful in and of itself. But also the fact that Jahangir is seen to receive these kinds of divine dream missives while in proximity to the body of Moinuddin Chishti, in sleeping directly over the spring associated with Moinuddin Chishti's daughter. Here, the idea being that he is also, that is Jahangir too, is endowed with some kind of spiritual capacity by virtue of his being a kind of inheritor of the Chishti spiritual largesse. And this is an idea that is kind of communicated in another set of dream paintings that I address in that same chapter. What's interesting to me is that, and I want to just make clear that this kind of iconography, right, depicting your royal patron and his dream in these kinds of loaded settings is highly, highly, highly unusual, at least in paintings. Not necessarily unusual when you look to the textual record. So it was not at all uncommon for historians, for Sufis to keep records of dreams that kind of look like this, that bear some of the same motifs that appear in this painting. By the way, the artist, Abul Hassan, was responsible for this painting that I'm describing. But it's really the Mughal artists who engineer the pictorial version for the very first time. So to kind of bring into color, into sort of the physical world, these visions that were otherwise historically recorded in writing, in manuscripts only. Mm-hmm. And then the artist, just one final word, I suggest occupies a kind of unusual place in the larger kind of hierarchy or equation of the dream and its creation, because of course it is Jahangir who purportedly has the dream, right? So he receives this this kind of vision from what is known both in Sufi but also dream discourses as the alam al-mitho, like they're from this world of images. It's the artist then who gives kind of physical shape to it. So he is proclaiming himself through his production to be, in effect, a kind of copyist of what is originally kind of a celestial image, God's image, that is then received purportedly by Jahangir. The painter kind of merely copies it, if that makes sense. So all together within this scheme, you know, the painters who are responsible for these works, who, by the way, are also some of them intimates of the emperor. They travel with him. They present gifts to him on you know, important ritual occasions. They're kind of negotiating all of this to fit within a system that will permit it.
This theme of kind of access to spiritual knowledge kind of carries over through kind of depictions of the imperial body. What was the way or how did painters play a role in cultivating the emperor's kind of earthly and spiritual authority through this depiction of the body specifically? Mm. And how were they kind of bringing together this kind of inner and outer character through mm-hmm. their depictions?
Mm-hmm. So the Mughals were not unusual in their interest, avid, deep interest in the science of physiognomy, right? Ilm al-Firasa. They are inheritors of that tradition, which the kind of central notion of which is that what we see on the exterior of the body or hear, so this extends also to voice, is a kind of index or register of one's inner kind of moral makeup, and vice versa, right? So what you see in the body is an expression too of, they go sort of in and out. What I argue is happening at the Mughal court that's a little different is, again, the production by painters of paintings that seem to allow for this kind of analysis. So, again, a practice, a tradition that's attested in verbal sources, so textual sources going back centuries, here in the 16th and 17th centuries, seems to be sort of filled in by paintings too. And what we see is a kind of explosion of what we could call portraits of the emperors, portraits of courtiers, portraits of ambassadors, and it goes on. Now, these have been regarded as, you know, being very, very detailed. Whether they are actually faithful to or necessarily kind of reproduce the appearance of their subjects, you know, one-to-one, I question. Because when you actually look at these portraits, and this includes the emperors themselves, they are on one hand very, very detailed. They sort of suggest a sort of individualization of the subject, and yet you see a idealization too, right? It's a kind of mix of the specific and the ideal, where, you know, all of the emperors, the princes, and members of their court, you know, sport, you know, similar types of facial hair, mustaches, but also, you know, postures. They carry themselves in the same sort of way. They become, through the production of their portraits, part again of a kind of single imperial body. Now, to return to images of the emperors themselves, I argue that their portraits, which I've already mentioned, appear also on these very special kind of gold coins that were awarded or given out to members and visitors to the court, that their images, in a way, become kind of exemplars, that, you know, to return to this idea of Ilma Frasa, if anyone is, you know, the most kind of noble, you know, on the inside, it's the emperors. And this is going to be, the case is going to be made through their physical appearance, through their portraits. And it goes beyond sort of nobility, something that I address in the first couple chapters, and which, of course, has been discussed at length by others before me. And I'm thinking, for example, of Asrar Moin's work on the millennial sovereign and so on, that, you know, the emperors are not just nobles. They are, in fact, they and their ideologues are making the case that the Mughal sovereign is a kind of messiah figure. And, you know, if we think too of the moment, right, the 1580s and 1590s during Akbar's reign, we are approaching the first turn of the Islamic millennium. There's a kind of millenarian fever, certainly within the Mughal Empire. There is much discussion about Akbar being this kind of you know, perfect man, this new redeemer who's going to bring during the second millennium a new age of peace and so on. And the evidence for Akbar and his line's ability to fulfill that role is going to be found not only in their kind of genealogy, their descent, you know, from Timur, from Genghis Khan, and many, many other kinds of bits of evidence, but also, again, as I argue in the book, in their faces, their bodies. There's much kind of fanfare made. Jahangir actually comments upon it in his memoirs, the Jahangirname, that his father had a mole shaped like a chickpea on his nose. And we see this mole actually depicted in a number of portraits of Jahangir, especially the posthumous portraits that are made during his son Jahangir's reign. And I talk about the significance of this mole and how it becomes a way to connect him with other kind of sanctified figures in Islam, including the Prophet Muhammad and others who were said to also have moles. So there are all these different ways that sort of, you know, close physical analysis of the emperor's bodies are become kind of entangled with these portraits that artists are making to be studied and to be circulated.
In the last chapter, you move towards kind of exploring the painter's role in the celebration of Nowruz, which under the Mughals was made to coincide with this imperial ascension anniversary. Can you talk about the types of ceremonies and events that were associated with these celebrations, and then how were painters participating in these?
So this is really important. As you mentioned, the Mughal Empire essentially adjusts the regnal calendar such that the emperor's accession anniversaries would fall on no roofs, right? So that didn't happen naturally. They couldn't decide when, you know, a given emperor was going to come to the throne. But after the fact that they could, you know, essentially move that anniversary to fall around March 21st or 22nd, which is the date of Nowruz, the, you know, falling on the vernal equinox. So this is really, really important. It becomes this kind of like doubly, triply potent occasion. And we have lots of information about how Nowruz was slash the accession or Julus in a anniversary was celebrated at the Mughal court, because it's talked about a lot in official sources. In fact, Jahangir's memoirs, the Jahangirname, is organized such that each chapter begins with Nowruz, right? It's ordered according to his own regnal calendar. And if you read the Jahangirname, you might be left with the impression that very little else happened except for the celebration of Nowruz, because the first number of pages of every chapter is just almost like a enumeration of all the feasts that were held, various kinds of ceremonies, and numerous, numerous, numerous gifts that were exchanged. So in short, these celebrations took place over a couple weeks. It wasn't just a single day. And as one would anticipate from in a royal and gift society, the burden of hosting and giving and receiving gifts was central. So important nobles were expected to host parties for the emperor. They were expected to be in attendance at official audiences that were staged, grandly staged on these occasions. And they would be expected to give massive numbers of gifts, including horses, gold, gems. If they were governors stationed in far off subas or provinces, they would be expected to give some of the fruits of those provinces to essentially show a sort of productivity and abundance. And they would in turn, again, this is kind of the compact of the gift, they would in turn be awarded increases, or hoped to be awarded increases in rank. And this is how things essentially operated. This was the kind of machinery of empire and its connection to these ritual occasions. Now, in the case of painters, right, they did not have gold and horses and elephants to give the emperors. It seems that their gift on these occasions took the form of, not surprisingly, paintings. And we have actually textual material evidence that this tradition of giving paintings on the occasion of the Nowruz slash Julus goes back to as early as the 1550s. And the reason I find this really significant is that the textual sources go at length to establish that in these cases of Nowruz paintings, what are known as Amali Nowruz or Nowruz works, that the creators of these works actually not only made them for Nowruz, but actually made them on the very moment of Nowruz, the very moment of the equinox. In some cases, we have inscriptions that state that the artist completed it in half a day or within an hour. So their kind of time specificity intrigued me and suggested to me that this is in a way a kind of opportunity for the artist to inscribe his work, what he actually does, figuration, painting, into this ritual cycle, and literally, you know, into sort of the very moment that the cosmic occurrences that establish the equinox occur. The painting I was referring to earlier by the painter Abul Hassan, this very, very famous work of Jahangir embracing Shah Abbas. And listeners, if you're not familiar with it, you can see it actually on the website of the National Museum of Asian Art online. This work bears an inscription stating that Abul Hassan executed the painting in haste because Nowruz was approaching. This seemed really, really, really important to me. One, to establish the idea that This is not just a painting. Again, I'm referring to this dream painting, not just a painting that the artist made on Jahangir's command, right? It kind of invests in the artist maker this level of agency that he's in a way kind of initiating this project, and the likelihood that he was executing it in the hopes of presenting it to his royal patron as his gift for Nowruz and the accession anniversary. Of course, it is also a kind of humble brag, because looking at the painting, you would never, ever, ever believe that Abul Hasan completed this work on haste. The way that these paintings are made, and I, you know, just to, you know, make clear to listeners that these are on paper, they are contained in books. They're small, but perhaps not as small as you might imagine. But you know, they would require months of skilled labor to build up the layers of opaque watercolor that are used to create these kind of sumptuous, highly detailed, color saturated, complicated compositions. So to come back to Nowruz and this, the whole kind of role of time within it, I think, you know, the Nowruz gift and the artist's kind of part in contributing a painting towards that end is a way, again, for the painter to inscribe himself within a kind of royal ritual economy that is separate from the kind of more mundane bureaucratic economy in which he normally operated, where the amount of time that he spent, for example, painting would have been recorded. This is actually how the workshop created budgets for manuscript projects. They had to know exactly how many days, or they would tell the artist, only work this number of days, because they did not have, you know, limitless expenses. So the artist's painting, in effect, existing within the ritual Nowruz framework, becomes this, you know, starts to operate on a kind of different order.
Now, there are tons of details throughout this book and dozens of images. I don't even know how many images there are. Is there any that you want to, you know, I don't know if there's something we missed that you're like, oh, man, I really want to talk about this, or some aspect perhaps of painterly court life that is essential for folks to know. But I want to give you an opportunity to kind of tease the book a little bit more if you'd like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are over 80 illustrations. And it's a kind of funny thing to talk about a book with many illustrations that is about illustrating, but without having the images on hand. So I've done my, I've tried to do some of them justice by describing them. I do want to say that many of them, one would be able to view online through museum and library collection websites. I think one that comes to mind is actually on the cover of the book, and it's one of my favorite. It comes from an album that was assembled originally during Jahangir's reign. It is added to or slightly adjusted during the reign of his son and successor, Shah Jahan. And then further things are actually done to this album in Iran, interestingly, where this album travels slash is taken during the 18th century, perhaps by Nadir Shah, who loots the Mughal court in the middle of the 18th century. So this is an important album, just to establish that important fact. And in its original kind of instantiation under the patronage of Jahangir, it's a kind of sort of book collection of favorite paintings, drawings, but also calligraphies that had up to that point been collected at the Mughal court. And we could think of it as almost like a museum in book format. And I make the case throughout the book that, of course, painters I think, had quite a bit of latitude in painting what and the way that they did. And I suggest in the case in this really, really important royal album, which likely was sort of shared, viewed by Jahangir in sort of the company of various people, court and visitors, that, you know, much of what we see is by the artist design, as opposed to this idea that, you know, Jahangir is kind of sitting in the workshop, looking over their shoulder, telling them exactly what to do, what to make, what to pair together. So the image that appears on the cover of the book is, interestingly, paintings of two painters. And they are both shown in the acts of paintings. And I talk about this particular detail because it's actually just the bottom half of a larger page from this album in the final chapter of the book, and about how it can be read as a kind of commentary on the acts of creation. Because in both instances, the artists are depicted executing paintings that are unfinished. So I kind of gloss this, I interpret this as a statement about the createdness of the imperial painter's work. Why is this important? Because although there's an abundance of figural images created at the Mughal court in manuscript and other media, there were still debates about the licitness of works like this. And I'm thinking specifically of certain hadith, one in particular that cautions artists that, you know, on the day of judgment, they will be called upon to breathe life into their creations. And of course they will fail because only God can do that. So this depiction of painters in the act of depicting, I think underscores their awareness that what they do is not on the order of what God creates, that they copy, they fill in with color the architecture of design, but ultimately it is kind of made by human hands, right? They're not going to kind of challenge God's creative authority. And as if to kind of, you know, drive home that larger point, the artist who is depicted on the left-hand side, who here, interestingly, is shown actually in the act of what looks like creating a painting of the Virgin Mary, behind him is a window, or what can be read as a window. And we see in this kind of window, this niche, this distant setting, a landscape scene that seems to, through the use of cooler colors in the background, it seems to show a kind of smooth spatial recession into the horizon. But its appearance here is kind of belied by its situation, its context within the larger setting, which shows a different kind of landscape. So in short, this kind of window behind the painter, one starts to kind of question, are we looking at what is supposed to be a window, or is it actually supposed to be a depiction of a landscape? And of course it is all painting anyway. So this is, in a way, just to kind of flesh out a little bit what's going on with the cover of the book, and how I think it kind of invites discussion and critical commentary on the very nature of depiction. What it is that painters do, what they contribute, and what they adamantly do not do.
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful book. Congratulations. And it was very enjoyable to read through, both from a kind of intellectual vantage point, but also from a spectator's perspective. I'm certainly going to return to it often. Before I let you go, I'd love to hear about things you might be working on now, or things that might be in the pipeline that listeners might be able to read down the road.
Yeah, I want to mention two things. One is a reader on Indian painting that I'm co-editing with another art historian, that's Dipti Khera. And this reader actually draws from the larger archive of about 75 years in date of Marg magazine. Marg, as some of your listeners will know, is a major art sort of publishing press based in Mumbai, formerly Bombay. And for now 75 years, they've been publishing kind of standalone volumes, but also issues of a magazine four times annually. And what Dipti and I have done is go into this vast archive and select articles that have been published either in the magazine or in these standalone volumes to be reproduced in this reader. I'm really excited about that because, and hopefully that will be out by the end of this year or early 2024. I'm excited about it because of its potential actually to be used in teaching, both in South Asia and beyond it. And I think it does something really important in establishing what the kind of impact that a press in South Asia has had on the field. So that's one thing. A second thing I'm involved with that I think connects much more closely with the Brush of Insight is a project on South Asian albums. So I kind of alluded to these types of objects in our conversation. The Mughals, of course, were not the only ones who patronized albums, these kind of book collections of paintings and calligraphies and drawings. The practice expanded across the subcontinent over the course of the 17th century. By the early 19th century, we have British patrons of these albums, French patrons. We have Rajput patrons. It's really become a kind of much, much larger phenomenon. And so I'm really interested in what albums become by the 18th and 19th centuries, how and why they circulate so widely, how and why they are revised, taken apart, edited by each subsequent owner. And you know what their, that is the albums, what their kind of geographical and political trajectories tell us about the lives of books and the makers and users of books around the world during the 18th and 19th centuries. So this project, in short, is bringing me into later periods that are new for me, kind of overwhelming, but also really exciting. And I'm curious also to see how I can bring the approaches and tools of digital humanities to bear on what is actually a kind of big data problem/project.
Too. Yeah. Wow. Sounds really cool. Very exciting. Well, good luck. And thanks again for making time to talk about this wonderful book. Congrats.
Thanks so much, Christian. It's been a pleasure.
That was my conversation with Yael Rice about The Brush of Insight, Artists and Agency at the Mughal Court, published with the University of Washington Press in 2023. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.